Well, coming off the Memorial Day weekend in June right around the corner, we started off the show remembering this date in history, the patent for the ice cream maker. So let's give you another summer-related thing that's worthy of recognition. Ron Toomer was born on this date in 1930. Ron Toomer was an American engineer, legendary creator of steel roller coasters. He's the guy.
Do they have a statue of him at Cedar Point?
I don't think so.
Probably should.
His early career in aerospace helped design the heat shield for the Apollo spacecraft, involved with NASA's first satellite launches. 1965, he joined an aero development company to apply tubular steel technology to the design of the Runaway Mine Ride, the world's first all-steel roller coaster. It opened the following year at Six Flags over Texas, and 10 years later, he designed the Roaring Twenties Corkscrew for Knott's Berry Farm. I don't think I've ever even seen that. That was the first 360-degree looping rolls. In fact, there were two of them on that ride. In all, he produced over 80 roller coasters before he retired in 1998. Ron Toomer, born on this date, 1930. Ice cream, get on the roller coaster, give it up, get some more ice cream, get on the roller coaster. Tough thing for roller coasters for me are the ones that beat you up. I can take the rides, I can take the spins, I can take the speed. I don't like getting beat up anymore like some of the old wood ones do to me.
You bruise your sides.
Yeah. Yeah. More than that.
You remember the ride called the Mouse?
No. Where's that?
Oh, it was a portable ride, although I think they probably had some stationary ones. I think maybe the old Coney Island in Cincinnati had one. But it kind of looked like a mouse. The car was shaped like a mouse. It just held one person. I think most of them did. And what it was really known for, it was on a track, like a roller coaster, but it would come to a corner and it would just take a 90-degree turn on the corner. It would pivot. And so it gave you the sensation that the car was going off the track. And it was a pretty cool ride, really. But when it would come to a corner and turn, the car would just snap you right into the side of it, and you'd, like, bruise your ribs.
Was that like the Scrambler?
No.
No.
No, no. This was like it. Kind of looked like a roller coaster.
Okay.
And it was I guess you could say it was a version of a roller coaster, but different in the fact that the cars were single cars and the track had square corners. And so you'd be 40 feet up in the air and you'd be coming down the track and coming to the corner and you think, oh, I've got to fall off, I've got to go off, and then bang, it would, you know, would do a 90-degree turn and go that direction. So, and you just go flying into the sidewall of the car and bruise your ribs. So it was one of those rides where you could feel it a day or two afterward.
I'll tell you the ride that I despise the most in my life, and this wasn't until adulthood. It's not a kid thing. If you go down to Holiday World, I don't know if it's still there. It's one of those things you go get on when the lines are too long at everything else. You know, just one of those side things that the kids typically ride. I think it was called the Spider, but it could have been the Octopus. Anything like that had eight arms, and you'd go up and down, and sometimes your cart might spin around.
I think we
call
that an Octopus.
Okay. Whatever it was called. I hated it because it didn't lock you in. I mean, not even close. The bar that came down over your lap, it crossed your knee. It didn't get up to the thigh.
So you better hang on for your life, huh?
And if you got to the upper level, and you know it would tilt, so there's some people who are close to the ground, and you might be up above them on the other side. If you got to where you spun to your back, you swear you're sliding out. Matter of fact, I know I was going to be sliding out if I wasn't hanging on for dear life. And then what happened? Got stuck. of all places, got stuck at the top of that dumb thing and stayed there for 45 minutes. Upside down. Well, not upside down, but upside down enough I thought I was going to land on my head.
Wouldn't it be a lot more fun just to go outside and look at the stars? Now, tonight and tomorrow night, especially tomorrow night, really, really good time to go out because the Jupiter and the Moon are going to be right next to each other tomorrow night. They're pretty close tonight. Jupiter would be just above the Moon and a little bit to the right. But tomorrow night, they're going to be right next to each other. So that ought to be a cool thing. About the time Venus is setting in the west, the Moon and Jupiter will be coming up in the east. And Jupiter, you might remember, Jupiter was at opposition on May the 9th. I think we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And opposition means that, well, think of it this way. So it takes the Earth one full year to make one revolution around the sun. And so at some point in the year, it passes all of the other planets. And when you get to a point where you could draw a straight line, say, from the sun to the Earth, through the Earth, straight line from the sun through the Earth to, let's say, Jupiter or Saturn or Uranus, whatever you want, that at that point, that planet is at opposition, okay? Which means that it's like looking at the full moon. So you see the planet best at that time. Now, because the orbits are elliptical, the distance between the Earth and that planet, in this case, let's say Jupiter, changes because of elliptic orbit. So one year, the opposition may be a little better because the planet's closer to us than some other year. Nevertheless, Jupiter, we were just at opposition to Jupiter a couple weeks ago. So it's a good time to go out and see Jupiter right now. So if you can, get a pair of binoculars and go out and look at Jupiter, and you'll see the different moons around Jupiter. If you go out a night or two later and look, you'll see that those moons have moved. Kind of fun thing to do. Great thing to do with children to give them a better idea of the planets and solar system, the creation, etc. So good time of year to do that. We're talking a little bit about new technologies, and I came across two articles that I thought were interesting. Number one, the first human corneas, okay? The first human corneas have been 3D printed by scientists at Newcastle University in England.
Okay.
Okay. And they're pretty excited about this because they feel like the technique will be used in the future to ensure an unlimited supply of corneas.
How long does it take to print one?
10 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And basically what they've done is they've come up with the correct mix, okay? But we'll get to that. The numbers are this. I think this was really, really interesting. We talk about there being a big, you're smirking.
Got something on my mind.
Okay. I'm sure it'll come out. There are about 10 million people worldwide who require surgery to prevent corneal blindness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, corneal blindness can be a result of eye diseases that are infectious, and so there's a big need for corneas. In addition to that, about 5 million people suffer total blindness due to scarring of the cornea caused by, could be a burn or a laceration, an abrasion, or like one of these diseases we just talked about. But the proof of concept research that these researchers did at Newcastle University, they published it in the Experimental Eye Research publication. And their report shows how stem cells and human corneal cells. Okay, so they get the stem cell and you program it to produce corneal tissue. Okay, so you take that cell and you mix it with collagen and other materials to create what they're calling bio ink. Okay. And that bio ink then is used by a 3D printer to print the new cornea.
I figure one of these days they're going to go make a cornea or something, but then lead scientist Bob is going to walk in, take one look at the finished product and go, who didn't load the cyan or the black? Somebody's going to be without a cartridge one of these days. It's going to screw up the entire project.
Yeah.
Don't you hate it when you print something in color and you realize you're out of color?
Yeah. Well, you could have, I don't know if you could use that, and the cornea is clear, so it wouldn't have anything to do with eye color.
Work with me, Bob.
Could you?
Maybe, whatever's in the cartridge.
Maybe you could program it to have a color. I don't know. I'm not sure you would want to do that, but nevertheless.
Can I go ahead and make colors so I can have cool eyes?
Kaleidoscope eyes?
Sure.
You know, that album came out 51 years ago, June of 1967.
Oh, my.
Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
Kaleidoscope eyes. Is that what you had in mind?
Actually, never even had that cross my mind, but okay. Okay.
Okay. So, the big news here, I think, is the BioInk. All right, the 3D printer that they use is a pretty run-of-the-mill standard 3D printer. Okay, the news here is they're perfecting the BioInk, and to that regard, who knows what other forms of BioInk will be perfected? Say like heart tissue or lung tissue, etc.
We'll never make the Frankenstein movie again, will we? Because there's no need to go to the cemetery and look for pieces and parts. The evil scientist will simply print them.
He'll be the
and
good,
what kind of a movie is
he'll
that?
He'll be the good scientist.
It's not even a fun movie.
Yeah, okay.
You don't need the lightning or the cemetery or Marty Feldman looking for the Abby Normal brain. You don't need any of that anymore. It's a Marty. Young Frankenstein reference for you.
That was... Igor, grab the bags. Oh, I'll take the blonde. Anyway.
Okay. Whose brain? Abby Normal.
Nearsightedness or myopia is an increasing problem around the world. I didn't realize this.
Okay? I didn't either.
There are now, scientific surveys show, there are now twice as many people in the U.S. and Europe with myopia than there were 50 years ago. Myopia, nearsightedness.
Then do we know why?
Why? Don't know.
So we're going to talk about delving into the problem after it's occurred, not necessarily
right.
stopping it.
Not the
all
cause.
The way.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So this is the effect. This discussion is about the effect, not the cause. In East Asia, 70 to 90% of teenagers and young adults are nearsighted. Some estimates show that 2.5 billion people across the globe are affected by myopia.
Is this computer related somehow? I don't know.
Don't know.
I'm just guessing.
Okay, so the current fix, the easy, quick fix, is you go to an optometrist, you get a pair of glasses.
Yep.
Or contacts. Okay, and if you want to go beyond that, you have LASIK surgery.
I never have looked to see if I'm eligible for such a thing.
Well, you may not be. If you have a thin cornea, okay, mm-hmm. So this is related to that last story.
Can I print a new cornea, then go in and get surgery? Or will printing the new cornea just make it unnecessary?
Well, printing the new cornea, you'd still have to implant the new cornea if that's what your problem required. Okay, but now Columbia engineering researcher Senisa Vukelic.
I'm glad you pronounced the name.
I hope that's close. Okay. He's developed a new non-invasive approach to permanently correct vision that shows great, great promise in preclinical models. Okay. He used a femtosecond oscillator and an ultra-fast laser that delivers pulses of very low energy at a very high rate of repetition.
I've got a couple of those back on the workbench.
You probably do.
I haven't used them in a while.
And what that does is very selective and localized alteration of the biomechanical, and the biochemical properties of corneal tissue. So this procedure is non-invasive. So with a LASIK surgery, right, they cut a circle around your cornea, lay that flap over, and then with the laser, they go inside behind the cornea and change your eye, okay? This doesn't do that. This, and so that's an invasive procedure, and with that you have risks and possibility complications, et cetera. But with this procedure, okay, you're changing the way the molecules in the cornea are formed. And so you can alter the cornea, right, by this procedure without an invasive procedure. Now, it didn't say this, but it led me to believe that this may be done over a period of time. So you go in, you get a treatment, and maybe you have to come back in a month or whatever. You know,
you always gotta tweak
it a little bit more, whatever. But
doggone it,
this could be a low cost, highly effective way to treat myopia.
Is it something that lasts, or does it have a 7-year limit or something like that?
No, no. Well, the critical component to this approach is that it induces low density plasma, which causes the ionization of the water molecules inside the cornea. And this ionization creates a reactive oxygen, what's called a species, okay? And it's a type of unstable molecule that contains oxygen and that can easily react to other molecules in the cell, which in turn interacts with the collagen fibers to form chemical bonds or crosslinks. And the selective introduction of those crosslinks induces the changes in the mechanical properties of the cornea. So you're using this technique to change the structure, the arrangement of those molecules inside the cornea for permanent change. Wow.
And your common eye doctor will be able to do this?
Probably.
Or will this be a high specialty type of thing?
Yeah, I imagine Ron McDaniel will get one of those machines pretty quick when they're available. You know, I mean, you can really treat, you can, if this proves to be true, that's a big if.
When he gets one of those, can he get rid of the thing that blows the air in my eye? Can't stand that thing.
Well, I think that's to test for glaucoma.
Oh, I know what it's for.
That's a different.
I know what it's for. I want to get rid of it.
I don't know.
Stop it. I can't stand that.
Anyway, also, there's interesting news about a novel RNA-modifying tool that corrects genetic diseases. And one of the big ones that they've had a lot of success with is using this new RNA modification tool to address triple negative breast cancer.
I don't know if I've even heard of triple negative breast cancer. I don't think I've ever heard of that before. What is that?
Triple negative breast. Oh, he's going to look here.
I'm Googling. I've never heard of that before.
You never heard that one? Oh, anyway, while you're doing that, I'll go on. Okay. Scientists are gaining more and more insights into which genes drive diseases, right? And they're pursuing the next logical question as they go through this whole process is that can gene editing technologies be developed to treat or even cure diseases? And to date, as I think most of us are aware, much of that effort has focused on developing technologies like CRISPR, which is a gene editing technique, okay? At the Scripps Howard Research Institute campus in Florida, there's a chemist there named Matthew D. Disney. He's a PhD, and he's taken a different approach to developing a small molecule-based tool that acts on the RNA to selectively delete certain gene products. So instead of changing the gene addressing the DNA and changing the gene, he's changing the products of the RNA to delete these certain gene functions.
And within this, furthering the story that people aren't fighting cancer, they're fighting and then fill in the name of the cancer. These are related but not the same diseases.
Yeah, it's very subjective. Yeah. It's not. We've always talked about, all my life I've heard, well, one of these days we'll find a cure to cancer. And that really is not true, because there is no one cure to cancer. They're different. Different types of cancers, different types of cures. Anyway, this tool is believed to open the possibility of creating drugs that can be very convenient to take, like a pill, to correct a genetic disease. And they work by destroying the toxic gene products and by chemically controlling the body's defense mechanism. Okay, this small molecule targeted recruitment of RNA was published online by the Journal of the American Chemical Society. And, quote, Disney said, these studies, like much science, were about a decade in the making. We are very excited to see how this initial application evolves. The research further shows that RNA is indeed a viable target to make medicines. That's a different approach. Okay, that could be revolutionary.
Some triple negative breast cancer facts, and I'm reading this from the TNBC Foundation website. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime. Triple negative breast cancer is just one of many forms of breast cancer. TNBC tumors are, and I know this will probably mean more to some people than it does certainly to others, estrogen receptor negative, progesterone receptor negative, and I don't know what this one is, HER2-negative, meaning they do not exhibit any of these three known receptors. 15 to 20% of breast cancer cases are labeled as triple negative.
Okay. And then there's a new robotic wine store that was...
A what?
Yeah.
Like wine, the beverage?
Yes, in Hong Kong.
Okay.
With no shop workers or cash tills and payments made using facial recognition, China's largest e-commerce platform, Alibera, created a fully automated wine store at Hong Kong's VinExpo Fair on yesterday. Billed by the company as a way to show off its latest smart tech to retailers, customers browsed a pop-up shop stacked with bottles set up inside the city's convention center for the annual wine show. All bottles are embedded with a tracking tag, so as soon as a customer picks it up, information about it shows on a nearby screen. Facial recognition allows customers into an adjoining payment room where sensors recognize which bottles they are carrying. RFID?
You've heard about China dabbling in facial recognition, too, as far as punishing people who are doing things that are not productive, helpful, etc. They're even catching people smoking in non-smoking places, and some of them are being sent letters saying they can't travel around the country.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that facial recognition stuff's getting a little scary.
And then real quick, to end up, why do trees sleep badly? I know you've always wanted the answer to this question. Okay.
If a tree sleeps in the forest and no one's there to see it.
Does it sleep well or badly?
I don't know.
You may think that trees and other plants are stationary and passive organisms. But then again, you may not. Okay.
They don't know what I'm thinking.
They just stand around all day. They don't do anything. Okay. But the point of this research is that plants also need sleep.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's good, I guess.
Sleep's an important part of the daily rhythm and serves to maintain body functions. During our sleep, the senses switch off, all the muscle groups relax, and you, I don't know, zone out, right? Plants don't have nervous systems or muscles, but they also become dormant when the sun sets and photosynthesis shuts down.
Well, so that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make
sense.
So their metabolism changes, okay? And so it's they need to sleep well.
So if I go for a walk after dark, I should like if I go into Meltzer's Woods after dark.
Yeah, don't smoke in Meltzer's Woods after dark.
Well, I don't smoke there during the day either,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's probably true, too. Yeah, so anyway.